From GPB News, this is On Second Thought. I'm Celeste Headlee. This week, we look back at some of the best conversations of 2016, and I let my team pick some of those segments. Today, producer and reporter Sean Powers gets his turn. Here he is.
Thanks, Celeste. I've worked on this show since it went on the air 2.5 years ago. I came to Georgia from Illinois. I had never lived in the South, never thought about living in the South, but I can tell you that I couldn't be happier to call Georgia home. And one of the things I love most about being part of the On Second Thought team is learning more about Georgia's history. So today I want to revisit some of our best conversations from the last year with Georgia history makers. We'll start off today's show looking back at the legacy of a judge from Savannah who ended up on the U.S. Supreme Court after a very contentious hearing. Then we'll chat with an Emory University professor who took part in a landmark libel case that pitted her against a notorious Holocaust denier. And we'll also pay tribute to some of the earliest black athletes from Georgia who went up against Nazi Germany and Jim Crow. Try wrapping your head around that one. And before we finish, I'll take you all on a very special trip to one of my favorite historic sites in the state.
Thank you, Sean. That is producer Sean Powers giving us a preview of his OST conversations featured this morning. And we'd love to hear from you. Let us know what conversations have stuck with you. What was the best you heard this year? You can call us at 404-500-9457. We're also on Twitter at OST Talk or post to Facebook, and we might feature your comments on the show. Just a note, the following conversation may include language that's challenging for some listeners, so listen with caution. A federal judge from Savannah, Georgia, made American history 25 years ago this year. Clarence Thomas was confirmed as an associate justice to the Supreme Court on October 15, 1991, but it was the media circus that surrounded his confirmation hearings that made Thomas a household name. A young law professor named Anita Hill came forward to testify against Thomas before the Senate Judiciary Committee. The nation watched in disbelief as Hill alleged that Thomas made unwanted sexual advances toward her. The descriptions were graphic.
He spoke about acts that he had seen in pornographic films involving such matters as women having sex with animals, and films showing group sex or rape scenes. He talked about pornographic materials depicting individuals with large penises or large breasts involved in various sex acts. On several occasions, Thomas told me graphically of his own sexual prowess.
Thomas denied any wrongdoing and threw his own accusations in a now iconic phrase.
As a black American, as far as I'm concerned, it is a high-tech lynching for uppity blacks who in any way deign to think for themselves, to do for themselves, to have different ideas. And it is a message that unless you kowtow to an old order, this is what will happen to you.
The U.S. Senate narrowly confirmed Thomas with a 52-48 vote. He became the second African American on the High Court. And for a look back on his tenure, I spoke with Georgia State University law professor Tanya Washington and Albany Law School professor Stephen Gottlieb. He teaches in New York. Tanya, this high-tech lynching that he was talking about, that very concept, is something that he's kind of stuck to throughout his career and has repeated in various permutations. I want to play this clip from a 2013 interview on C-SPAN. They asked Clarence Thomas if he ever thought he'd see an African-American become president, and here's what he said.
I knew that it would have to be a black president who was approved by the elites. The media, because anybody they didn't agree with, they would take apart. And that will happen with virtually, you pick your person, any black person who says something that is not the prescribed things that they expect from a black person will be picked apart. You can pick anybody. Don't pick me. Pick anyone.
I'm going to pick him, though, because it almost sounds as though he's responding to people who say that he's too conservative. Is that fair?
I think what he is trying to say is that unless your politics or your expression of your politics is aligned with the established order, the status quo, that you are not going to be deemed acceptable or appropriate, and that determination, your qualifications are made based on that rather than you know, the quality of your analysis or the work that you've done or, you know, your educational background, et cetera. And I think, you know, he has been consistent because his comments there describing why President Obama was an acceptable candidate, despite the fact that he was African-American, is in line with his own his comments about his own confirmation.
And Stephen, what do you make of this? I mean, especially the hearings, without us retrying the Anita Hill, Clarence Thomas confirmation hearings, do you feel as though Clarence Thomas has been able to move away from that and have his legal career be judged separate from the confirmation hearings?
Oh, I think that's true. Despite the fact that he doesn't speak at oral argument, his opinions speak very forcefully for a point of view. And by the way, I think he's right that there is an extra millstone on the neck of African-American candidates. And they get...
Do you mean any candidates or candidates for the court?
I was being more general. Mm-hmm. I think he's quite right, and I've seen it work where people misinterpret what African Americans say and their positions, which may have something to do with why he does not speak. By the way, he does speak. It's just not public. He speaks to Breyer all the time.
Yeah, I don't think anybody thought he was mute.
They tell jokes to each other, and it's obvious from the audience in the court.
We're going to get into that, but let's go back a little further in his history and talk about his growing up in Georgia, because it's something that he has talked about as helping to form the justice that he is. Here he is speaking about his early days in Savannah.
I was the only black kid in my seminary in Savannah in 1965 to 67, and one of two in 1964 to 65. So you could see the world hadn't changed in Savannah. What I found in getting along with the white classmates is to look at them not as white kids or as different, but as kids. There's some less flawed, some who are flawed, some less flawed. I don't know. But in the end, they're all human beings.
So Clarence Thomas was born in Pinpoint, Georgia, in 1948, which was not an easy time to be a black kid in the South. How do you think that experience may have influenced him as a juror?
Well, as he expressed, he tried to see kids not for their color, but as just children that he was in classes with. And I think if you fast forward to a lot of his jurisprudence that expresses the idea of colorblindness as the constitutional ideal that we are going to apply the law without regard for color, it's consistent with the ways in which he navigated those spaces where he was the only black person, was to not see the color of his classmates. And perhaps, you know, in his experience, that made it easier for him to navigate those challenging spaces.
There's some other things that he did. He dropped his Georgia accent. He made sure that he was a picture-perfect example of a smart, educated human being.
He attempted to assimilate, and he also worked really hard not to fit the stereotype. But in doing that, you don't give yourself permission to be yourself. We don't have to be perfect as black people or black jurists to be equal. And that attitude of I must assimilate in order to be treated as equal, I think, resonates throughout a lot of his opinions as they relate to topics around race.
I wanted to go back, Stephen, to your comments about Clarence Thomas not talking. And when we say he's not talking, he's not speaking up or asking questions pretty much hardly ever during his entire time on the Supreme Court. In 2013, he actually broke a 7-year silence. There was a discussion going on about the qualifications of an attorney. It sounds like Thomas was trying to poke fun at the expense of Yale Law School. So Thomas uttered 4 words. Well, he did not. Let's take a listen here to what he said.
But Ms. Lehman at that time was a very experienced attorney.
And another of his counsel, Mr. Singer, of the three that he had, he was a graduate of Harvard Law School, wasn't he?
Yes, Your Honor.
Son of a gun.
very is that the minimum constitutional?
He did not.
He says, see, he did not provide good counsel. But it wasn't a question. People keep waiting for him to question people. Stephen, why doesn't he?
He hasn't told me, to be honest with you. one can speculate that there's been he has said from time to time that he doesn't see a lot of benefit in the process of oral argument, and therefore doesn't participate, although he's there, and he's there and he's active in other ways. So he gets books delivered to him. He sends things back. You can see that there's a degree of activity, that he's present during the arguments. He just doesn't articulate what's going on in his mind and hand for the audience.
And that's one way in which he's sort of distinguished himself is by being silent. But another way, Tanya, is that he was not the African-American judge many African-Americans were waiting for. In other words, somebody that might bring a very different, more sympathetic perspective to the court. Here he is during a forum at the Pepperdine University School of Law. He was asked about whether or not the Supreme Court has a role or a duty in combating racism.
I have never understood the notion that we could continue to focus on race in order to get over race. I've never understood that we have to continue to identify us in a, you know, to be race conscious in order not to be race conscious.
What can we glean from his decisions on issues of race?
Well, I think he's summed it up. He is of the mindset that the way to get over racial discrimination is to end racial discrimination. In other words, not to see race, to adopt a colorblind perspective and a colorblind jurisprudential philosophy where the law is neutral and takes no account of racial inequities, racial disparities, racialized realities. And that comes through in his opinions in the voting rights context, in the context of affirmative action, employment discrimination. So his perspective is one that if we really want to become a colorblind society, which he perceives as the ideal, the thing we do is to ignore race. Others who critique that perspective say, how can we eliminate racial discrimination, which clearly still exists by, you know, hard evidence,
right?
How do we get rid of that without first acknowledging the history and the reality of racism?
The voices there of Georgia State University law professor Tanya Washington and Albany Law School professor Stephen Gottlieb. Just ahead, we look back at the 1936 U.S. Olympic team that included black athletes who braved Jim Crow and Nazi Germany. First, though, a fascinating story about justice. Can it be illegal to call a lie a lie? This is On Second Thought. This is On Second Thought. I'm Celeste Headlee. This week, I let my team choose their favorite conversations and stories that have aired this year. And this morning, it is producer and reporter Sean Powers' turn. He's dedicating today's show to Georgia history makers. I often joke with him that he books some of the most fascinating people on days when I am not hosting. And that's the case here. In October, my colleague Adam Ragusa was filling in for me when he got to speak with Emory University professor Deborah Lipstadt. 16 years ago, she found herself at the center of a unique legal battle that pitted her against a Holocaust denier. The libel case attracted international attention. Lipstadt wrote about that experience in her book, History on Trial. It's now been adapted into a film called Denial, starring Academy Award winner Rachel Weisz as Lipstadt. Let's now return to that conversation.
The man who accused you of libel is a guy named David Irving. Here he is in a BBC radio interview explaining why he went after you.
Lipstadt is part of an international conspiracy to silence me and destroy my career. And I could look up the slope and see this mudslide thundering down towards me and about to engulf me totally and wipe me out. And I decided the time had come to start hammering pegs into the landscape, as David Lipstadt now knows. When people use their Jewish networking to disadvantage David Irving gets up and fights back.
And in the film, we first meet David Irving in a scene where you are giving a lecture. A person in the audience asks why in your writing you disparage Irving's work where he denies the Holocaust, and here is your response as portrayed in the film.
To be honest, I don't think I do denigrate him. Actually, I don't really think about him that much. I don't think he's important. Yes, sir, gentleman in the back.
Professor Lipstadt, let me reveal something to you, Professor. I am that David Irving about whom you have been so rude. Yes, yes, I am he. And it puzzles me that you think yourself qualified to attack me, given that I have 30 years' experience in the archives. And my books have been published by some of the greatest publishing houses in the world. Viking Press, William Morrow, E.P. Dutton. I have to conclude that the reason you don't engage with people you disagree with is because you can't.
Now, Deborah Lipstadt, we're going to talk about all the very serious issues raised by your story about the nature of Holocaust denial, the nature of libel laws. But first, I think I just have to ask you the question that probably everyone and your mother has been asking you for a while now, which is, what was it like to see this very, very difficult part of your life portrayed by a Hollywood film?
It was an out-of-body experience. It was very strange. But it wasn't like I signed over the book and then sat down in the theater a couple of years later and saw the film. yeah. I was very lucky. I was brought into the production of the film. David Hare, the screenwriter, who did a magnificent job with the screenplay and much of the film, the text of the film, comes from the actual transcripts of the trial, shared various drafts with me. It came to Atlanta, followed me around, saw me teach at Emory, talked to my students, talked to my colleagues. And then Rachel Weisz brought me into, at the very beginning, as soon as she started preparing for the role, I spent a couple of days with her at her home. She would call me before she did a certain scene. I'd often be on the set. So it wasn't a complete surprise yet. The first time I sat down to see it on a big screen with a test audience of about 500 people, it was very weird.
But did it put you back in the mindset of the time and provoke feelings of anxiety? Did it sort of was there a little bit of PTSD there?
No, it didn't provoke feelings of anxiety because I know the ending. So spoiler alert, I win. But it did. It was difficult, especially watching Timothy Spall's unbelievable recreation of David Irving. It reminded me of why this man is so contemptible. You pick up a bit of it in the clip you just played. He is a conspiracy theorist. He's a racist. He's an anti-Semite. And he lies, and then he believes what he says.
We're speaking to Emory University professor Deborah Lipstadt. She is the inspiration behind the film Denial that chronicles her experience when this Holocaust denier sued her for libel for basically saying that basically saying everything she just said about him just now. Deborah, take us back to the beginning. Where does this particular strain of Holocaust denial come from? There must be some intellectual basis.
Well, I don't know if you could we can append to conspiracy theories an intellectual basis, because it's a very skewed vision of the world, whether it's a conspiracy theory about the Holocaust, whether it's a conspiracy theory about 9/11, about vaccines, about Sandy Hook, the city in the town in Connecticut where those children were murdered, which now some conspiracy theorists say was all a setup, you know, to get gun control legislation and things like that. Conspiracy theorists have a very skewed view of the world. You know, the moon landing was in, I forget if it's Utah or Nevada or whatever, those kind of things. So I wouldn't give it an intellectual basis, but what I would say is that Holocaust denial is a form of anti-Semitism. You know, it wants to deny that the Jews suffered, and it wants to claim that Jews who today talk about the Holocaust are doing this to get special privilege, to get sympathy of the world. It's not dissimilar to people who don't deny that slavery took place, but they'll tell you, oh, slavery really was not so bad. You know, the slaves had 3 square meals. They had a place to live. They could sit around the campfire at night and sing all those pretty songs. So let's not feel so bad. It's a recreation of what was, a rewriting of what was.
Now, David Irving sued you for libel. Libel means It means that you have he's accusing you of having defamed him in writing. Libel's always written, right?
Right, correct.
Defamed him in writing, and what we mean by defamation is that you have said stuff about him that, or written stuff about him that is discrediting and this is the really important part, false. Right?
That's
correct.
Not
defamation if I say stuff that's bad about you that's also true.
That's correct.
So the nature of this trial fundamentally came down to determining whether or not it really is true that the Holocaust happened, right?
Well, we try to stay away from that. The strategy of my magnificent legal team was we had to prove that what I said was right. And the way we did it, and that's why I originally called my book History on Trial, which has now been reissued as Denial, was to follow the footnotes. You know, we followed the footnotes back to their sources. So each time David Irving said, I can prove that, you know, there were no gas chambers, or I can prove that Hitler tried to stop the riots in November, the riots and pogroms and killings in November 1938, I have a document which proves it. We would follow that back to the original document. And not in most instances, and not in the preponderance of instances, but in every single instance where we went back to a source where he wrote something about the Holocaust, we found an invention, a misstatement of fact, an inversion of dates, putting people at a meeting who weren't there. It's what our expert witness, Cambridge University professor Richard Evans, called a tissue of lies. And the judge agreed with that 100%.
Let's listen to another clip from the film Denial that is about your real life experience. During the trial, you did not take the witness stand, which was a point of contention between you and your legal team. So here's a scene from the film in which Rachel Weisz, who's playing you, and actor Tom Wilkinson is playing your attorney, Richard Rampton.
Our strategy is to keep the focus on Irving and Irving alone. It's not a test of your credibility. It's a test of his.
You don't think I'm good enough?
No. I didn't say that at all. Everything you have to say, you've said in your book. Our task is to starve Irving, and putting you in a witness box would feed him. This case is happening to you, but it's not about you.
Deborah, why did you ultimately decide not to present your own evidence in this case?
Well, it wasn't that I decided. I was told quite specifically by the lawyers that they were not going to call me. In British law...
You didn't have some choice about it?
I didn't have it. I kept saying, I want to go on. Look, at some point, you've got to trust the experts. It was hard for me. It's hard for me to trust anyone to take control of something about my life.
Well, also, you're a lawyer. I mean, doctors are the worst patients, right?
No, I'm not a lawyer. I'm a history professor.
I'm sorry.
The only thing I know about law is about being sued, you know, and being turned down for jury duty. I've been turned down 3 times, so I think I'm out. They made it very clear. It took me a long time to accept it because I was really afraid people would say I was a coward. But as Richard Rampton or Tom Wilkinson says in the clip you just played, it wasn't about me, and I had to keep sort of my eye on the prize, as we say, and that was on winning this case. And what they argued is, you're being sued for what you wrote in your book. We have to prove that what you wrote in your book, i.e. that David Irving is a Holocaust denier, an anti-Semite, a racist, and that he lies and he does it deliberately, won't be helped by your going on the stand. We want to keep the focus on the book and on what you wrote. And at some point, rather reluctantly, I had to accept that. I knew people wondered why I didn't go on. I wasn't talking to the press either. And I have a lot of friends who say that the greatest miracle of this whole case was that I kept my mouth shut during this period. But I understood. I understood. It took me a long while, as the movie makes clear. But at some point, I understood I had the best lawyers, and they knew what they were doing. And I had to let them run it as they thought best.
Let's listen to your attorney, Richard Rampton. This is the real Richard Rampton, not the actor from the movie. Here's Richard talking about a key piece of evidence in the case with the BBC. The key evidence was Irving's diaries, which Rampton described as a gold mine in this case. Let's listen.
Because what they showed was, first, that he was an enthusiastic participator in events organized by neo-Nazis and right-wing extremists. But second, which did surprise us perhaps a little more, was that according to what he had written, he was profoundly anti-Semitic, which does rather suggest a motive for his adulation of Hitler.
So, Deborah, spell this out. You've talked about this a little bit, but just this is such a complicated case. Make it clear. If this was a libel case where you had to prove, in a sense, that the Holocaust actually existed, why were these diaries relevant?
The diaries were relevant because they showed intention. They showed intention. In the diaries, we kept finding overt anti-Semitism, including songs he sang that he made up for his daughter, which were both racist and anti-Semitic. We found that he spent time when he came to this country. He would come here. He would vacation very often in Key West. And he had an admirer in New Orleans who would come down to visit him, and that was David Duke. He spoke to far-right-wing extremist groups. I'm not talking conservative. I'm talking far-right-wing, white supremacist, racist groups when he came to this country. So we showed that this man, though on the surface, he acted like he was a very respectable writer of historical works, but that he had this other life, which very much infected what he did and what he wrote and what he said. So we were able to show that connection quite strongly.
And because libel cases hinge on the question of veracity, this also spoke to the veracity of your claim that he was an anti-Semite.
That's right. That's right. And again, we also showed, we went in thinking we would prove just that he was an anti-Semite. But as we went through the material, I mean, I have made the case in my original book, the book that caused the suit, that many white supremacists like Holocaust denial because it sort of validates Hitler had very contemptuous feelings towards quote-unquote people of color and black people particularly. And he always wanted to show them as inferior. So Holocaust deniers also like to, you know, connect with the white supremacist movement. So we were proving both. And the diaries really were a gold mine. And I never saw the diaries. I never was even in the same room with the diaries. But the lawyers and the experts went through them and found just damning evidence.
Your judge in this case was a gentleman named Charles Gray. And after the trial ended, he talked with the BBC just to make it clear this is the real Charles Gray, not the portrayal of Charles Gray in the movie Denial that opens up on Friday. The real guy. Let's listen.
I've had my share, I think, of quite large libel actions. None quite so substantial, I think, as the Irving trial. A unique case. One can't imagine that there'll be many other cases, whether in the guise of a libel action or anything else, which will raise the same sort of often horrifying issues as that case did.
So, Deborah, have there been lasting effects in the legal community from your case?
I think so. There have been some effects on libel law in England or cumulative. My trial was part of a cumulative impact, which now makes it a little harder to sue for libel because it puts such a burden on the defendant. But in terms of history, this I can speak to much with much more expertise. It's given the lie to what I call hardcore Holocaust denial. Those people who say, you know, there were no gas chambers, the Germans never intended to kill the Jews. Hitler, as David Irving would say, was the best friend the Jews had. David Irving, by suing me, and I'm so glad you mentioned that and repeated that, and I want to stress that, because there are people who think I sued him, but I don't.
Right.
I don't believe in history in the courtroom. I think they're two separate entities. By suing me, made a mistake, because suddenly lies he'd been saying and statements he'd been saying were now being checked, and people were asking questions. And just because you say, you know, it goes to a contemporary situation, the difference between fact, opinion, and lies. If I said to you, it's my opinion that the earth is flat, you would say, Deborah, that's not an opinion. That's craziness. But it speaks to that. And he went into a courtroom where there was a judge who would determine that what he was saying was based on lies and was falsification of history, which he did deliberately.
My colleague Adam Ragusea speaking with Emory University professor Deborah Lipstadt. She's the inspiration behind the film Denial. The movie chronicles her experience during a libel trial between her and a Holocaust denier. Just ahead, how two Georgia athletes risked their lives to compete in the 1936 Olympic Games.
There was very definitely a special feeling in winning the gold medal and being a black man. We destroyed his master race theory whenever we start winning those gold medals.
This is On Second Thought. It's On Second Thought. I'm Celeste Headlee. All this hour, I hand the keys to the show over to my producer, Sean Powers. He's featuring some of his favorite conversations from the year about history makers from the Peach State. Up until now, we've looked back in recent history, but let's turn the clock back 80 years.
Hitler was riding high when the Olympics were held in Berlin, and he made the games a background for his own propaganda. This was the kind of show that Hitler loved, for he was dreaming of world conquest.
Adolf Hitler opened the 1936 Games with a brief statement. He said, quote, "I declare the Berlin Games, celebrating the 11th Olympiad of modern times, open," end quote.
Ich verkünde die Spiele von Berlin zur Feier der 11. Olympiade neuer Zeitrechnung als eröffnet.
As the crowd cheered, 18 African-American athletes, including two from Georgia, prepared to take center stage. They competed in front of Hitler and the rest of the world, of course. A new documentary tells their story. It's called Olympic Pride, American Prejudice. I spoke about it with filmmaker Deborah Riley Draper. And we also talked with former Atlanta mayor Bill Campbell, who served in office during the 96 Summer Olympics in Atlanta. I started off by asking Deborah about the two Georgians on the team.
Ralph Metcalf was born in Atlanta, Georgia, and of course, he was a part of the 1932 Olympics. His family moved to Chicago in the Great Migration. So he won medals in 1932. He won medals again in 1936. But what's interesting about him is he goes on to become a congressman, and he co-writes the resolution for Black History Month and is the co-founder of the Congressional Black Caucus. So he has set this path that we all have benefited from since the day he was born here in Atlanta.
And he got to compete in the 1932 ones, but you have this commentary from your documentary. You talked with Olympic athlete John Brooks's daughter, Daria, and she talks about how difficult it was for her dad to get into the Olympics.
You know, my dad wasn't allowed to compete in 32, even though he qualified, because there was a white athlete that the team had decided they wanted to push. And he told him, "You cheated me, but you won't get the chance to cheat me again."
And he did, of course, compete in 1936. So, Bill, what made the change in those 4 years? It's not like we made some big racial breakthrough in the United States. Why was there such a difficulty in getting onto the 32 team and then they were able to get on in 36?
Well, Avery Brundage, who unfortunately besmirched the entire Olympic ideal, also removed two Jewish members from the 1936 games going to Germany. I think ultimately for African Americans, what sports represents is a definable beginning and an end, and you're measured by what you're able to do in that interim. And they simply were not able to keep African-American athletes out in 36 because their performances, they had gone to more colleges, they were being accepted across the country, and the numbers that they were putting up in terms of their times in these events was so outstanding they simply could not be kept away from the games in 36.
And we actually have another clip from the documentary. You mentioned Ralph Metcalf of Atlanta. He would later become, as you said, an Illinois congressman. In this interview that you included years later, he's talking about the fact that he was so upset about the decisions that were made to appease the Germans.
I resented the fact that they left two Jewish boys off of the team, Frank Stoller and Marty Glickman, in order to satisfy the Nazi people over there. It was our team. We were not supposed to have Germany dictate to us, nor their philosophy, nor their politics to us, because we selected our own team and we should have fielded our best athletes.
And yet there was fear of the safety of some of these athletes going to Germany, ruled by Adolf Hitler at that point. Was there a hesitation upon the part of some of the athletes, or what kind of preparations did the Olympic Games do to keep them safe?
Well, you have to remember, leading up to, in the run-up to the 1936 Olympics, there was a huge boycott in this country. The country was divided. There was a part of the country that didn't want the American team there at all, and there was a part of the country that did want to support the German games. And these African-American athletes realized that this was an opportunity to be on the world stage. So regardless of what potential threat or what potential harm they may encounter, they wanted to go.
This is from a 1996 oral history interview, and the the clips that you got are incredible in this documentary from, but this was done for the U.S. Holocaust Memorial Museum. Again, we hear the voice of gold medalist John Woodruff. He's talking about winning the men's 800-meter race in the 1936 Olympics.
There was very definitely a spatial feeling in winning the gold medal and being a black man. We destroyed his mass race theory whenever we start winning those gold medals. So I was very proud of that achievement, and I was very happy for myself as an individual, for my race, and for my country.
Okay, so, Deborah, the effect on African Americans especially seemed to have been quite strong, and I want to play one more clip before we get to you. And this is Andrew Young, UN, former UN ambassador and former Atlanta mayor.
And a great swimmer, by the way, at Howard University.
And he ran track, too.
Oh, did he? I didn't even know that one. Anyhow, he actually remembers watching the 1936 games with his dad.
My daddy took me to see the movie-tone news version of the 1936 Olympics. And I can remember going to a segregated movie, which we didn't do often, but he thought that was important. So we climbed up in the balcony and we saw the 100 meters.
He's talking about when he, in your film, he talks about going into there and his dad even going into a segregated movie theater, which they didn't usually do, just because he wanted to see them succeed. So the impact on African Americans seems to have been huge.
It was huge. Wolfie Frazier says that he's Louise Stokes' son. He said, whether or not the broader community understood, these were heroes in the neighborhood, and those heroes made more heroes to keep it actually going. And the fact that if they weren't there, we wouldn't have the integration in sports we now know. It could have taken 20 or 30 more years if 18 African American Olympians had not been on the world stage in 1936.
You can join this conversation by tweeting us at OSD Talk or go to Facebook. My guests are filmmaker Deborah Riley Draper and former Atlanta Mayor Bill Campbell, talking about the new documentary, Olympic Pride, American Prejudice. It tells the story of 18 African American athletes who competed in the 1936 Summer Olympics in Berlin, including two from Georgia. So, Bill, they return home, and when they first get home from the Olympics, they are treated like heroes by the wider public, are they not?
Momentarily.
How long
it was one day?
Really? The moment lasted 24 hours?
I think all of us understand that 1936 was a particularly difficult time for America in terms of race relations, and these athletes who had just really demolished the entire racist theory of Nazi Germany unfortunately came back and expected that they would be welcomed and treated in the way that you would imagine for sports heroes, but it did not happen that way. They were lauded in their own community, but as soon as they got into the broader community, it was right back to the same segregationist practices that they had endured even before they left.
And this is a time when, especially here in the South, for the athletes returning to Georgia, Jim Crow still was the law of the land.
Well, let me just say this, Celeste. We have talked about Jim Crow in the South, but the entire country was racist. And let's not talk about just the South and Jim Crow. They had a different brand of racism in the South, but it was all over the entire country. Jesse Owens was, and Metcalf.
Ralph Metcalf returned to Chicago.
Yes.
Jesse returned to Chicago. Dave returned to Ohio. Archie returned to California. So there was an institutionalized racism that was pervasive from coast to coast. We kind of branded as Jim Crow, and we oftentimes pigeonhole it into being a certain thing, but there was second-class citizenship afforded to African Americans in the country.
And by the way, Celeste, the reason that you were asking initially, the reason these 18 athletes got into the games in 36 was because they were allowed entry into universities that were principally in the North and in the West, and that's how they were able to compete. There were no Southern universities that were allowing these athletes to compete on the track and field teams. And in fact, that didn't happen until, as you know, way far into the 60s. So that just was not the way their avenue to get into the Olympic Games.
And when John Woodruff came back from the Olympics, he was at Pitt. When he returned, he was still on the team at Pitt because he was just a freshman. He actually came down to Georgia, and he came down to Annapolis. And when he tried to compete at Annapolis, the team was not allowed to compete because John Woodruff was on the team. So, as a gold medal winner.
One of the things that you lay the case for in your documentary is that these 18 athletes helped to lay the groundwork for what would eventually become the civil rights movement. Why do you say that?
Well, I think it's like former Mayor Bill Campbell said, when you have 18 African-Americans who are able to defy what is, you know, defined as Jim Crow and defy Aryan supremacy and stand on the world stage and represent the United States, even when they cannot vote, their mere presence sent a message. And because they did it, 10 years later, Mack Robinson, who was on the 1936 Olympic team, his brother is able to integrate baseball. Now, of course, Mack Robinson was born right here in Georgia.
Yes, and as was Jackie.
As was Jackie. But Mack Robinson had to instill a certain level of courage and have that conversation with his brother. And it may have gone something like this. Hey, Mack, I'm going to integrate baseball. I think it's going to be kind of tough. Well, really, I faced Hitler. I think you can handle it. You know, so, but seriously, these guys afforded us the opportunity to think bigger, to think on a global stage.
Bill, you were the mayor of a city where the civil rights movement really got a lot of its start. Do you buy this argument that these 18 athletes helped set the groundwork for that?
Not only did they set the groundwork for it, but I think there's a straight line from these athletes to John Carlos and Tommy Smith in the 68 games. In fact, for me, that moment in Mexico City when those two fabulous athletes raised their fists is still the most iconic moment in sports for most African Americans of my vintage. And the fact they also live here and I had the honor of meeting them was one of the great moments for sports for me. And I think when you look at the fact that there was so little that African Americans had to cheer for or anyone to recognize their achievements, that is what really allowed so many African Americans the moment of pride and dignity. And it began this whole effort to start the civil rights movement and stand up for what they believe. And by the way, as Deborah was pointing out, and I think she points out in the documentary, there was considerable consternation even amongst the African American community in 36 as to whether or not these athletes ought to go and in essence be utilized by Avery Brundage and the Olympic Committee as the superior athletes, and yet they were not going to be treated well when they were here. And so the African American community in 1936 was split as to whether or not they should even allow themselves to be utilized in that fashion.
So we only have about a minute left, Deborah, but that particular part of the documentary reminded me of the debate that went among African Americans when Barack Obama was running for president. Why is this story still relevant?
Well, the story is still relevant because if we take a look at what happened to Louise Stokes and Tidy Pickett in 1936, and we fast forward 80 years, the conversation and the rhetoric around Gabby Douglas,
the gymnast.
Absolutely. So she's experiencing the same language and the same violent comments that Tidy and Louise experienced in America when they were the first two black women to ever represent this country as Olympic heroes. And you would think in 80 years, the conversation would change and it would be reframed. It's not depressing. It's something to point out so that we can understand that we actually need to deal with our implicit bias.
Filmmaker Deborah Riley Draper and former Atlanta Mayor Bill Campbell. Deborah's documentary is Olympic Pride, American Prejudice. It's nominated for an NAACP Image Award for Best Documentary. We just heard about the role of two African-American athletes from Georgia who paved the way for future generations. Remembering the lives of African-Americans is something Oakland Cemetery in Atlanta is working to do. It's trying to identify hundreds of unmarked graves. Over the summer, groups of all ages were invited to tour the cemetery's historic African-American gravesites. My producer, Sean Powers, who's been curating today's show, tagged along, and he brings us this audio postcard.
The African-American burial ground at Oakland Cemetery demonstrates racial segregation in America, in life and in death.
My name is Joshua Julius. I am 9. I'm about to turn 10 in July. It's important to remember all of them because they could have made a difference. It could have been a small difference or a big difference, but they both made up where we are now.
Earn the right to be treated equally with whites, even in death.
So see, that's very good, Joshua. Look at the pictures that are here. See, that young boy may be about your age, and he's drinking from a water fountain. And what does this say?
Colored.
I'm D.L. Henderson, and I'm a volunteer and board member with the Historic Oakland Foundation.
Okay, keep looking. Let's see, what do we have here? Can you read that marker? And the kids have a cultural treasure hunt that they're following to look at, to find out all about the historic treasures that are here in the cemetery. Okay, now look at the second question. What's the second question?
Says most African Americans living in Atlanta were enslaved before the Civil War. Find the grave of someone who was born during slavery before 1866.
Right. So before this, many of the graves, if you look all around you, you won't see marked graves, but there will be people who are buried there. We recently did a study with ground penetrating radar. Right? And they sort of took a camera, basically, rolled it over the ground, and that's what showed up on the film, those where we have those orange markers. Yeah. So that showed probable grave sites. So we may already have most of this. There were 872 probable grave sites listed here that we see with the orange markers. But keep in mind that over 12,000 African Americans have been buried at Oakland since its founding.
My name is Tamia Lewis. I'm here with my daughter, Anaya Lewis. She's 7. I want her to learn about African American history, learn where our ancestors come from. Where she's just getting to the age where I feel comfortable introducing her to things and teaching her about, you know, American history, slavery, and things of those nature.
It's pretty sad that people were slaves.
I don't think she can fully grasp it quite yet, but I think she's slowly learning how serious and how important it is.
You guys want to walk around some more? Or are you ready to go back up? You've been down here a while. You've been down here a couple of hours. So good work. So turn your cultural treasure hunt in back at the table up there. And they'll give you a little keepsake to take with you to remember your day. Thank you for participating in our hunt.
An audio postcard from producer Sean Powers' visit to Oakland Cemetery in Atlanta. And that's our show for today, but we'd love to hear from you. Tell us what was your favorite conversation, your favorite story from 2016. Let us know at 404-500-9457. You can also find us on Facebook or tweet at us. It's at OST Talk. For today, that's On Second Thought from GPB News. I'm Celeste Headley. Have a great day.